Well, welcome. This is a session on, this is the title, The Big Money Versus Our Democracy, Big Money is Winning. And the title, I gave it, the political systems corrupted by money, corporations have more power than people, big money rules our economy, and political system, we're ill-equipped to address the challenges facing us. That's my premise. I don't know how much disagreement there is necessarily on that. There was a poll in Minnesota about 10, 15 years ago by Common Cause. Actually, I think it's 20 years ago now. Common Cause, the government reform group, paid to have a poll done, and they asked voters, do you think that politicians are more responsive to people who give them, to entities, people or groups that give them money, or to voters? It was a close call. It was 88-6. Some people didn't know, but 88-6 thought it did. And then they asked a follow-up question of people who had acknowledged not having voted in the most recent presidential election, which is hard to find because most people who don't vote don't acknowledge that. But they found the people who were saying, no, I didn't vote. And the vast majority of them said that one of the key reasons was they didn't think their vote made any difference. Mm-hmm. They were as strong as anybody else and believe in money talks, money makes a difference. This quote I put up here, I don't know if you can read from Bill Moyers, was the cover story of Sojourners magazine a couple of decades ago. Yes. The impact of special interest money on our democracy isn't as bad as you think. It's worse. You didn't think Bill Moyers would actually say that. But Bill Moyers had worked, he was a top aide to Lyndon Johnson in the 60s before he went into his long career in journalism, and he's probably one of the most astute observers of the American political process. And I think over the years, my background, I've now been in elective office for 30 and a half years. Our state senate terms are 4 years, but every decade we have a two-year term because of redistricting. So I've run for office 10 times. I've won my senate seat. I ran for governor once and lost in November of way back in 1994. But I've always run my campaigns with no PAC money, no lobbyist money, no soft money. All but two of them have I run with nothing more than $100. Which some people say it's tying your hands behind your back and so on, but it's something we have to do differently. When you talk about what Bill Moyers says, most politicians would say, oh, that's the public doesn't get it. The public thinks money is corrupting our political process. But it's not. I mean, yeah, there might be some crooks, but their way of seeing what corrupting it is if somebody gives you an envelope full of cash and asks for a political favor, they would see that's not happening a lot. Well, I'm sure it happens. Once in a while, people get caught with that. But I'd say both people of both parties, by and large, would be horrified if somebody offered them cash and expected a favor for it. And most of the time, they would, I would assume 99.9% of the time, would chase away anybody trying to do that, whether it's because they're horrified at it or because they're afraid of getting caught. You can't tell people's motivation. But most of my colleagues of both parties would say money is not the problem people think it's a matter of perception. Several number of years ago, I was trying to make it so that any contribution from a lobbyist to a public official would be disclosed. Mm-hmm. Right now in Minnesota, it's anything under $200 is disclosed. And people would say, well, people might misunderstand. If they know I'm taking $100 from a lobbyist or something, and it's somebody that is what I do anyway, it wouldn't change my vote or anything, so the public wouldn't understand. They might think something was amiss. Well, that suggests to me some misunderstandings, because they're convinced there's no problem, and if we're disclosing it, it might give people the wrong impression. Maybe we have to rethink how we work. I would try and make the case that people are influenced, that it's not a problem of corrupt people, corrupt donors, corrupt recipients, some are, But most politicians, I would venture to say, Minnesota and probably most other states in Washington, I hope they're not people who would be intentionally corrupt, but they are, every one of them is human. Psychology textbooks 101, psychology will talk about the concept of reciprocity. Mm-hmm. You give somebody something, even something they don't want, and they feel obligated to repay you. I worked 20 years ago, I succeeded at banning gifts from lobbyists to public officials. It's the end of the world as we know it, if some people thought. If we couldn't do it, and what's the wrong? You think you can you be bought for a dinner? If you can, you don't belong in politics. And the reality is human nature is such that we are influenced by it. And unfortunately, it's not the small things that are the biggest deal, they do have a real impact. But the problem with money in politics is it not only influences the people in office on what issues they talk about and so on, it also has a huge impact on who wins elections, who is in office. And one person said, if this were NASCAR, members of Congress would have corporate logos in the which would be much more upfront and much more disclosure, perhaps, than we have these days. And but I think it would be a nice idea. Yes. Real briefly, I want to talk about an illustration, just one illustration. U.S. Supreme Court for 40 or 50 years has been saying you cannot limit spending by candidates. You may be able to limit how much in contributions people receive, but you cannot limit how much they spend. The theory is in a democracy, the First Amendment, the Buckley-Vallejo case in 1976, they said very eloquently what the purpose of the First Amendment is. Roughly speaking, it's to promote the most widespread, comprehensive exposition of every kind of point of view, no matter how unpopular, how extreme, how whatever, so that the electorate has the chance to weigh all the merits of all the issues and make decisions on it. And I really think that's a good articulation of what the First Amendment's purpose is and why it's so important. We want to have that happen. And they conclude that because in the same decision, which is sort of the core decision that everything up and beyond Citizens United case that many people are familiar with is based on, they were convinced that the more money you have, the more speech you get. They're thinking societal-wide. It's also true individually. You have more money, you have more speech. Why did they think that this would help the First Amendment? If I speak without a microphone, I can be heard by a handful of people or 50 people or so. If you give me a microphone or a megaphone or whatever, it might be several hundred people. You give me access to a newspaper, I might have hundreds of thousands of people. You give me advertisements or access to the airwaves, you can have billions of people. And you can have access to them. So more people can hear more things if you've got more money to do it. So the court said we can't limit that. And the cases over the years have become much and much worse. One illustration here I'm going to use is a group. I had never heard of it, and I doubt any of you have either. It's called Carolina Rising. This was founded in 2014. It's an IRS code 501c4. 501c3 ones are the ones that you can donate money to them tax exempt. You can write off contribution to 501c3. 501c4s are social welfare organizations. This one was formed in North Carolina. It was very successful. This first year, it raised $4.9 million, $4.8 million of which came from a single person. We don't know, single entity, thing, person, whatever, we don't know, but it came from one person, undisclosed, because 501c4s don't have to do that. What social welfare purposes did they spend their $4.9 million? 97% of it, $4.7 million, went to an advertising firm to run ads praising the North Carolina, I think he was the Speaker of the House at the time, who was running for U.S. Senate, a guy named Tom Tillis. They were, unlike a lot of these political expenditure things were positive ads. They were saying how this guy really loved education and he supported teacher pay increases. The Republican Party of North Carolina apparently must have been hammered for hurting education a few years earlier, so you look, you can see hundreds of ads from Republican candidates in North Carolina about how they wanted to raise teacher salaries, they care deeply about education. Anyway, they spent $4.7 million running, I think, a series of three different ads throughout the year. That comes in a problem because of that $5 million to promote a successful campaign. They're not allowed to spend more than half their resources on political activity. They're also not allowed to function for the private benefit of any individual or select group. Center for Responsive Politics, as Carolina Rising, appears to have broken both rules. They covered it saying, oh yeah, they were educating people. That was their social welfare purpose on issues. They were advocating them. Though the filings with the Federal Elections Commission by the advertising agency said ads on behalf of Tom Tillis, a candidate who they were praising in various ways. Unfortunately, while this is allowed, this one anonymous entity giving $5 million to elect a U.S. senator, and they were actually merely augmenting the work of much larger groups. Americans for Prosperity, the Koch brothers group, ran attack ads for a full year on Senator Kay Hagan. They ran the negative ones, and Carolina Rising ran positive ones. In the end, the last on election night, by the way, some reporter went and took a picture of their headquarters. The address they were given was just a sign on a wall. It was in a office building. None of the tenants knew there was a nonprofit there. They actually, it was a post office box in that building. And outside of the $4.7 million that they spent on ads for this guy, they spent virtually the rest of their money went to a limited liability company formed by the same political consultant who formed Carolina Rising. Presumably that paid his salary or whatever. That kind of thing happening where people, outside groups come in. In Wisconsin, the year after Citizens United, there were a number of recall elections, you may recall, but if you're from Wisconsin, you may know particularly, but they had, I think there were like six state senate races that were having recalls. The spending in those races was in the terms of several million dollars apiece, whereas typically a race in Wisconsin is well under $100,000. But most of that money, I would care to bet, did not come from in Wisconsin, certainly not from in the districts. People who are supposed to be choosing their representatives in government, they have one vote, but people coming in and pounding in over and over and over their heads that this happens has a much bigger impact on it than what you talking to one neighbor can do. You can influence a handful of people. You put millions of dollars into a state legislative race or many millions into a congressional race, you can buy yourself an elected official. And the Supreme Court, when it's in the Buckley-Valeo ruling where it said more speech does this, the reality is it drowns out all other points of view. If you look between the year 2000, the year 2004, campaign spending roughly doubled. Between 2004 and 2008, campaign spending roughly doubled. We're finding an exponential growth. You double and double and double again, you get 16-fold what you had 20 years ago. It's going up far, far faster than inflation. And candidates, the number one qualification for candidates getting elected is the ability to raise money. Candidates drop out of races because they can't raise the money to do it. It's interesting, 60 Minutes did a story a couple years ago, I think this was in 2015 or so. Fundraising demands turning lawmakers into telemarketers. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how much of this you can read, it's fairly faint, but a Republican congressman from Florida won a special election in 2014. His number one priority, he was told, was fundraising. He told 60 Minutes he sat behind closed doors with party leadership where he told he had 6 months to raise $2 million. Your job, new member of Congress, is to raise $18,000 per day.
This is his party telling him?
This is his party telling him. He told 60 Minutes the schedule of Congress is arranged around fundraising. He called the setup shameful. It's beneath the dignity of the office that our voters and communities entrust us to serve. This is back in 2016 that he was running for the, planning to run for the Florida Senate seat that would be vacated by Marco Rubio, because he said Rubio was running for president, said he wouldn't run again for Senate. When he lost the Senate race, the presidential race, he did decide to go back to it, so Jolly did not run for that. But it's not a partisan thing. Rick Nolan, a member of Congress from Minnesota, he got elected in 1974, I think, to the U.S. Congress. He served until 1980 and stepped down. He did not run again. He has the distinction of having the longest sabbatical between terms in Congress. He left in 1980. He got reelected in 2012, 32 years later. And so he's one of the people who has a very different perspective. He could see what it was then, and you know, if you're there all that time, you might kind of lose, things change over the years, but you don't quite realize it. He came back and he co-authored the same bill that this David Jolly was pushing. He said both parties tell new members they should spend 30 hours a week on calls. He says that prospect is keeping people from running for office. Yes, I think many of you, if you thought you could make a difference in Washington, a difference in the state capitol, or a difference on a school board. School boards, fortunately, aren't, in most cases, that kind of spending and process that's happened here. But Nolan said, I could give you names of people who said, you know, I'd like to go to Washington, help fix problems, but don't want to go and become a mid-level telemarketer, dialing for dollars, for crying out loud. He said they really expect 30 hours a week. Policymakers for our nation are supposed to go. They actually both parties, and they actually got, somehow they got a, 60 Minutes got a camera into, I think, the Republican one. And it's basically right off Capitol Hill, a block or two away. So members of Congress, because you can't do political fundraising from your federal offices, so they have offices, both parties have members of Congress just a short block or so away. They can go there and sit down, they have somebody with them, a script, names of people to call, asking, could you give me $1,000, or if the person's better off, maybe ask for more money than that. We need it. We need the money. We need to do it. That alone should tell us something is amiss with our political process. With our nation's political leaders. And Rick Nolan says when he was in Congress in the 70s, he said, we really worked hard. He said they'd give us 4-day weeks because people were flying home to be in their districts over the weekend. But you had committee meetings all day. He said, no, there's very little. It's expected to be spent your time fundraising. And again, these two guys are probably in fairly competitive races. If you're in a race that's a solid Democratic or solid Republican district, you probably don't have to do as much of this, though you have to do some of it to be leadership because you're expected to give money to your caucus, your party, to your other colleagues so you can get the majority or maintain the majority. What kind of impact is this on issues, on public policies? I talked yesterday, I think it was about healthcare. This is a picture of Max Baucus, a former U.S. Senator from Montana. During the fight for the Affordable Care Act, he said he was the chair of the Senate committee that put together the bill. The way you can say when I say that, when Barack Obama signed the Affordable Care Act, he called out at the signing ceremony Senator Max Baucus, saying that he was the one who wrote the actual legislation. Because the way things were going in the House, it had to happen in the Senate, they had to get something together the House would take up. And Baucus was the one who made it happen. And talking about universal health care, which was what Obama and many politicians talked about, giving health care to everyone, Baucus said, it's not on the table because it cannot pass. One time they had some doctors and nurses at one of his hearings back then, and in a congressional hearing, one of the nurses stood up and said, I want to know why you won't talk about it. And he ignored him and gaveled him out of order, and the security carried the person away, and as soon as that person was on the way out of the room, a doctor stood up and said, "How come you won't let us debate this?" Now, they did this, six or eight doctors who were hauled out of the room in the hearing for it. But Max Baucus was not willing to support it. Why does money have that impact? Well, politicians like Baucus receive big dollars from medical industries, not just pharmaceutical and insurance, but also medical professionals, many different ones. I think I looked at the numbers for Baucus a couple years ago. In the 6 years before the Affordable Care Act legislation was written, he had received, I think it was like $600,000 or $700,000 from those industry groups. To the extent we know, those were the big donors from those industries. That has an impact on them. The more money they raise, the more likely they are to win. So the people who are in Congress are the ones who tend to be the best at getting those interests. And obviously, politicians who like something like universal health care are afraid talking about an issue like single payer is too controversial, could cost them the election. Not because voters may object to it, voters largely wouldn't know what it is, but groups who benefit from the current system do know, and they give money that way. How does that make a difference? Is the result a surprise? His top health care aide was a former WellPoint vice president. She left WellPoint to come work in his office. At the signing ceremony when Obama pointed to Baucus, and he's the one who wrote it, and Baucus turned to his aide and said, "She's the one, the genius behind it, she's the one who put it all together." It's not a surprise the insurance industry may have liked that.
Yeah.
I decided when I was first elected, first time I ran, I took contributions from anybody who gave. I voluntarily agreed to spending limits, which back in 1986 when I was running was, for state senate, was like $35,000. It's been inflation adjusted over the years since then. It was a decent system. You cannot, because of the Supreme Court, you cannot bind somebody, require a candidate to abide by spending limits. You could do it voluntarily. In exchange for voluntarily spending no more than $35,000, I had the benefit that donors to my campaign, Minnesotans were able to give at the time up to $100 a person and get it all refunded to them through our tax system. Mm-hmm. So you could give money at no expense to you. It became refundable, not a refundable credit, but it became a rebate. So you give $100 to one candidate or 50 to two candidates or something, you'd get the money back from the state in order to encourage small contributions. I agreed to the spending limits. My opponent did not. He knew he was going to win. He knew he could raise lots of money. So he didn't get the public finance money. And he spent $55,000, $60,000. I did win. He was expected to win. All the groups that endorsed him. One of them, a week after the election, I got a letter from a lobbyist who still happens to lobby in Minnesota. He sent me a nice handwritten note. "Dear John, congratulations on your election. You showed hard work really matters." Mm. He said, "Here's a contribution." From one of my clients. They contributed to your opponent during the campaign, but they went to make amends. They erred. They picked the wrong candidate. The issue, which was fairly obscure, it was a fight between optometrists and ophthalmologists in terms of licensing. I probably didn't have a stand on the issue, not a strong stand. I can't remember the details of what the issue was, and I'm sure my opponent didn't either. It was not discussed in any campaign debate, anything else. I wouldn't know what my opponent's stand was. I don't know if my opponent did either. The reason they gave him money was they knew he was going to win. And they may have, I think he used the term, the misfortune of having contributed to my opponent. Why was it misfortune? Well, he didn't win. I could see that as an insult, so they were making a contribution to me. So I very quickly realized that this is not a good system to do and return bigger contributions I had and set a policy of nothing more than $100 and no PAC, no lobbyists, no soft money. But it does have an impact. It determines who runs for office, who wins, how they vote, what they talk about. 10 or so years ago at Holden, we had a congressional candidate from Minnesota who was defeated, and he was saying the biggest discouraging thing about it was because you spend all your time calling people who have the ability to give you $500 or $1,000 or $2,000, it changes who you are. All of your conversations relate to their interests and their concerns. And people who can afford to give $1,000 or so are not the average person. There may be a lot of people who can afford to do that and who do that, but it's a tiny, tiny percentage of the population. And the perspectives of people who are homeless, the perspectives of people who are struggling with things, the perspectives of the small business owner who can't make ends meet, is not going to be heard the same way the ones who have the money are. Before we get into what we can do, I wanted to say that there are a number of ways we can see the impact of this issue. Certainly on specific requests for money. There are a lot of businesses, entities, others who, we want small government, we want less government spending, we want whatever. However, we want money ourselves. One of the biggest ones people in Washington State, people in Minnesota may be familiar with, is the request of money for subsidizing certain private businesses. One of the most visible ones, because of public interest and attention, and always gets to hot discussions, is building sports facilities for people, welfare for people who least need it. What is his name? Paul Allen, the former Microsoft co-founder, who owns the Seattle Seahawks, I believe, maybe some other teams. Back about 15, 20 years ago, they had a stadium that didn't serve their purpose. I don't think it was fully paid off yet. If there's somebody from Washington who remembers this, you can correct me if it was not paid off at the time. And they decided, they said, you know, we would like to have a chance to get public financing for this, and we think the voters should decide, so we'll have a referendum. They wanted it, I think it was during a primary, because they wanted lower turnout. And they offered even to pay, I think it may have not been during a primary, I think it was a special election just to deal with that one issue. And they offered to pay for the election judges and so on, which is a couple million dollars or so, to get election judges to run the polling places, everything paid for by one side of it. The state of Washington, I believe, at least at the time, had a booklet publication they put out before an election with any voter ballot initiatives. We explained each side would get a point to make their arguments for what the merits of their case were. And he put in a little thing in his, and the other side put in their arguments against it. But having debates, he refused to debate. But he literally paid for the election as well as paying for the, outspent the other side 10 to 1. I don't know what the numbers were, but it was overwhelming. And he spent just the right amount because he narrowly got it passed. Mm. He got large amounts of money. In Minnesota, we had in about the year 2005 or 6, we got a new donor in Minnesota, a businessman from New Jersey, who of course didn't have a lot of reason to contribute money in Minnesota, but I think that first year in 2006 he gave $90,000, and between this individual and his brother and his cousin and their spouses, it was very evenly split. It was pretty close to $45,000 for Democratic candidates in the Democratic Party and for Republicans and so on. Why giving to both sides? They can't make up their mind. No, the reason he started investing in Minnesota was because he purchased the Minnesota Vikings. And even though they were very successful, the previous owner 6 years earlier so bought the team for $200 million, sold it to him for $600 million. Even though they were making profits every year, operating profits, and the value of the team going up, they wanted a stadium. And I think in a political process, people have a right to say, we want a subsidy for this. But why is he giving this money? Well, he gave money year after year after year. It kept growing in value. He tried to split it, of course, to favorable politicians. But he gave, in many of those years, he gave to the Democratic Senate caucus, Democratic House caucus, Republican Senate caucus, Republican House caucus. 2006, I think he gave money to the Democratic, the Republican, and the Minnesota Independence Party was fairly big. He gave money, the maximum, to all three of the major party candidates for governor. And so enough that they spent, that was the campaign contributions, only a small portion, but the rest of it's advertising how wonderful, how we love the Vikings. Well, I love the Vikings too, but I don't know that the taxpayers should be paying the bills. He ended up getting a stadium out of it. It took until 2012 to get the new stadium. It's a big thing, it's a beautiful thing. And they said, oh, people, once it's built, they're gonna love it. Well, if somebody gave me $1 billion to build a facility, I think I could make a pretty beautiful thing. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, the taxpayers put a lot of money into it. They reported it as $400 million. Oh, we'll make it up because it's next year. The Super Bowl is in Minnesota because we built a new stadium. And but we'll make it up, so don't worry, it's not a big deal. I like to break down millions, billions. We, most of us as ordinary people, don't get the numbers. They're just big numbers. But I said $5 million in that cent raise. What's the difference between that and $500,000? Most of us, if it was in our bank account, we might understand, but it's big numbers. So I broke it down and calculated. Forbes magazine ran an online thing with a letter to my colleagues trying to make the case against it, and calculated that, not counting the property tax break, because it's a public stadium, they get all the money from it, but it's on public land, a public stadium, and so we property tax exempt, including their restaurants and bars and everything in the facility. But the net value of the rest of the subsidies we gave them from the city, from the state, from everything else, break down to a total of $72 subsidy for every ticket to every game, including preseason games, for the next 30 years, which is the life of the stadium. So everybody who goes to the stadium, if Tanya and I go to a Vikings game, we don't go to a lot of them, it's kind of out of our price range and not her interest, but we taxpayers be subsidizing over $140 for us to go to the game. Mr. Wilf is not, he was a judge in New York, calling New York State, and something was calling totally unethical, and all sorts of other things. Maybe not the best person you want to give money to, but maybe he needed the money. Well, he put $600 million into it. The team was worth over $1 billion before the stadium was put in. Forbes' latest estimate is that it's worth about $2 billion now. He did not need the money. But it's pure greed, and giving money in politics does that. Why did I use that as such a long example? Because to show the difference it is in other worlds, if we allow that kind of conflict of interest, people would say, that's wrong. In politics, he's known as a generous donor, a big player in the process. So candidates routinely call people like him because he places a phone call, okay, he'll give you $1,000 instead of 5,000 or whatever, but they give you money. Well, supposing, take another realm of endeavor that Mr. Wilf, the owner of the Vikings, also might understand, National Football League. Supposing he decided before the next Vikings-Packers game, we got the Packers shirt there, before the next Vikings-Packers game, that these officials, who have good folks, they're pretty hard-working folks, you ever meet some of them, they got a tough job and they make a bad call and people really ride them and harass them. What if Mr. Wilf decided to give $1,000 or $2,000 contributions to the officials before the next Viking-Packer game? I don't think the Packer fans would like it. I don't think the league would like it. I don't think the public would accept it. Matter of fact, I think what the league would likely do would be fire the officials and kick the team off the field, forfeit the game. Why? Because it's patently obvious there's a conflict of interest. They're not going to go and say, we're going to watch those officials like hawks to make sure they're not throwing the game to the Vikings. They say you can't do that. Mm-hmm. And for a sports contest, that's probably a good thing to do. Maybe our democracy is worth more than that, however. So how do we move forward? And I'm going to open this up for discussion in a minute, but how do we move forward? What can we do? Disclosure is important. In that case in North Carolina, who gave that $5 million? There is suspicion because one guy who had worked with this individual who's given a lot of money, clearly could have been the one who gave that $5 billion, but we'll never know. A disclosure is important because if people know so-and-so and such-and-such interests, the tobacco lobby giving money to a candidate 30 years ago, if that was all disclosed, voters, opposing candidates and others could say, well, you know, I want to reform, I want to promote public health, I want to do something against the tobacco industry. I'm not taking their money, look what my opponents do. It can help. Disclosure is very important. I'd say disclosure is essential. Matter of fact, U.S. Supreme Court in Citizens United said, you know, the public can find out, they can make their own judgment based on that information, as if the public's going to go through FEC filings and look at the disclosure. But disclosure is important, but then even then the U.S. Supreme Court did nothing to make it happen, and they basically allowed all these loopholes, so most of the money, what they're calling dark money, is not disclosed. We've been trying to get that disclosed in Minnesota. A lot of states have been trying, but it's very hard. We don't know. Disclosure is important, but it's not enough. Even if you could be told, or even if somebody puts $5 million into it, there was a U.S. Senate race in Pennsylvania several years ago where a candidate was driven out of office with a bunch of last-minute attack ads saying he supported one small expenditure for somebody in Iowa's a law school library in honor of a former U.S. senator or something. And somehow they were running ads saying this guy was not a popular thing at the time. Apparently this guy was doing something wrong, and the guy had no clue this was an issue. A week before the election, 2 weeks before the election, get bombarded with ads attacking. Disclosing who's putting the money into those ads, you'll never find out. Even if you did know, it's not going to help that much. So you kind of have to say, is democracy about people deciding where their government should go, or is it about money steering people as if we're puppets and telling us how to do things, which doesn't mean we're naive. It means we don't have a choice because we don't hear anything but the drumbeat that comes there. Clean money reform. My argument is, and I think it sells well with the public, is we should own the special interest ownership of elections and public officials. We should replace it with public ownership, public financing. I had a bill back in 1993. That was the year after Ross Perot ran as a third-party candidate for president. Kind of a unusual guy. He was not mean or anything. Very wealthy individual. Very interesting guy. He actually did pretty good. He got, I don't know, 15% of the vote or something. Spent a lot of his own money on it, but he got a lot of people, I remember at the time I was 25, 27 years younger, but I remember at the time a lot of older folks, a lot of old white guys were coming into these hearings. They formed this group, United We Stand America, was the Ross Perot group. And I had this bill I had introduced, nothing more than $100 contributions and some public financing, banning all PAC, lobbyists, soft money, et cetera, contributions. And these guys were coming in, they wanted to support my bill. And this is kind of a strange group, I didn't know how to react to them, and Ross Perot was an interesting character, and they were interesting folks, clearly engaged politically, clearly wanted to be. They were frustrated at the big money in politics and so on. They said they wanted to support my bill, so I sat down with them. We discussed the bill, and I said, you know, I explained what the bill did, and I said, I don't want your support for the bill if you just want to ban these things. I want your support of the bill to include the public financing, which will cost a few million dollars. Meaning your tax dollars are going to go to fund a bunch of politicians, including ones you can't stand. And maybe they couldn't stand anyone, but your dollars are going to be going to fund them. So I don't want your support without that. And they called me the next day or a few hours later and said, we unanimously agreed to support your bill, all of it. And they came and they sat in the hearings. And I happened to be chairing the Government Ethics and Campaign Finance Reform Committee, so I could schedule the bill. I was presenting the bill, my vice chair was leading it, and somebody offered an amendment to take out a provision of the bill. These guys are grunting and making signs that they were very uneasy with it, and sure enough, a few reporters would come up hearing this in the microphones or whatever, they'd come up and watch, and somebody would draw the amendment. That went on for months at a time. But my bill would say we should put public money in as well. This kind of thing happens all over. Maine was one of the few states that had passed a few years earlier a public financing system. It wasn't a super comprehensive thing. This is November 2015. Huge effort to defeat this, but Maine voters suggested they wanted to put more public money into elections because they think there's going to be an election, the public should own it. In Minnesota, again, my proposal was public funding after meeting matching funds. I would like to have this nationally the way we ought to do it. The way we have to do it in these proposals, the last line here, if you can read that, candidate who agrees to the limits gets funds to counter the big money. You get, if you agree to do this, you could raise nothing more than a limited amount in small $50 or whatever contributions, and the rest of your money would come in public money. And you would, depending if you had a primary opponent, you'd get more money. Both candidates would have the same right. If you agreed to abide by these limits, the other side can spend whatever they want. But we would say, what I've been trying for 20 or 30 years, or used to try, was to say that if the other side gets spend whatever they want, or their independent expenditures of $1 million going against you, you'd get $1 million in public finance money to counter it. That way, all the sides would get an equal airing of, or roughly, ability to spend on the race. Why do you have to do it that way? Because the Supreme Court says you can't limit spending. You can't force somebody to these public financing thresholds. I would argue we ought to change it and have a system where you just say, here's the way you do it. Other countries, we got elections that the day after the election, people start campaigning for 2 years, 4 years down the road. People are sick of elections in our country. Most European countries, very brief, 3 weeks, 3 months, somewhere in that range for elections. We cannot limit the length of them, but if we limited the spending on them, which would require change in either the interpretation of the Constitution or a constitutional amendment, which gets me to one other proposal. This Congressman Rick Nolan from Minnesota, who was the one quoted in 60 Minutes saying how different things had become and how terrible it was. He's carrying this proposal in Washington, D.C. I had carried a bill that got through our Senate a couple years ago, but not through our House, that would basically be pushing the U.S. government to adopt this constitutional amendment. And the wording of it is such, it basically says, corporations and other human-created entities are not people. They have rights and responsibilities that we give them under the law, but they do not have the constitutional rights that the rest of us have. They do not have the constitutional rights to influence our elections. And the other portion of it is that money is not free speech. And it would be explicitly saying Congress and legislatures have the requirement that they must regulate the flow of money in politics, and I can give you plenty of schemes on how you could do it fairly, but they must regulate the flow of money in politics to meet one standard, and that is that no person has significantly more political clout than anybody else because of their money. The Koch brothers could have as much clout as everybody else, and but they don't get the chance to put in hundreds of millions of dollars, which frankly I don't think anyone in this room could match. That's the issue we need to do. There are two ways to do it. One, Supreme Court could change its tone. I'm not optimistic of that happening in the near future. And number two, we could do it through a constitutional amendment. That also is a tough sell. Bill Moyers, in talking about this, said that he pushed once on his TV show several years ago, this move to amend group, without their being aware of it. He just said, when people tell you it's a almost Herculean task to amend the Constitution, tell them that you still have the most important role in a democracy, that of citizen, and no fight like this was ever easy. So he's arguing you ought to make it happen. In any case, bottom line is, here's why I think we ought to be doing this. The first Tuesday after first Monday in November is what we're supposed to call it, an election, not an auction. Government belongs to the people in a democracy. And I cannot picture our nation's founders envisioning anything like we have and calling them elections, calling them fair, calling it a good way to make a democracy. So with that, I want to open it up for questions. It's about 10 to 12, and I think this was scheduled until 12:15, but if there are questions, we'll go that far. Yes?
You had up there earlier, PAC money and soft money. Would you do anything to change it? Distinction between those two.
Oh,
I understand, you know, the lobby.
That's older terminology. People softly, well, actually now, most of the money is soft money. It's money that's not bound by limits. All of the, what we call dark money from Citizens United. It basically, in the past, corporations couldn't directly give money to political campaigns. They could actually give money to a corporate PAC or to other things in. By laundering money, people were able to find ways to make big things. But now anybody, any entity can do it. And that does run afoul. We do have prohibitions on foreign money in our political system. Well, how, when a corporation is making funding, what about if you're a shareholder from China or something, you own businesses here, can you give money in the political process? But it's totally unregulated. I would not use the distinction between soft money in the past was people who give money, was the independent expenditures of old. Now dark money, the new independent expenditures, we have no idea who's doing them, we have no way of tracking it, they don't have to report it to the FEC. You're only a political campaign expenditure if you expressly advocate, you say vote for or vote against somebody. That's why for years you were seeing the loophole they were using is tell so-and-so to stop stealing your Social Security, or tell so-and-so to do this, or thank so-and-so for this. Why are those running right before the election? Because they're campaign ads. But that's the difference. Yes?
So if the people who have to change the financing system are the same people who are benefiting from the current financing system, where is our hope and what are we supposed to do in that process?
Very good question. And I'll give you a historical reason for hoping.
Yeah.
Until about about 100 years ago, only a small portion of our population, less than half of our population, was entitled to vote. Male population was eligible to vote. They elected male politicians who set the laws and wrote the Constitution and everything else. And some people didn't think that was fair. A lot of people didn't think it was fair. They started fighting to change that. They had no chance of winning. I mean, for the same reason you just said, how are we gonna change this? They did prevail. It took them some time, but they did prevail. And my frustration is that the news media, even people who say we gotta reform campaign finance, don't look at the big picture of what's a democracy about? Is this what we're supposed to be having, where money talks more than people? And so it's frustrating to me how many politicians say, yeah, we got to reform campaign finance, but they don't even see the big picture. Women's suffrage movement was very clear. People are people. We all ought to have a voice. And even though it was rigged against them, we had no chance of winning, they did. That's about the only answer I can give, and that's to say it's a very tough way to go, and you're pointing out why it's difficult. Yes?
Going back to the constitutional amendment, I've heard the argument against it that if you take away the freedom of speech of corporations, it would mean that you could monitor, like, news corporations and restrict their freedom of speech. What would you say?
Okay. A couple of things. First of all, newspapers and the media is already has, we have a free speech constitutional right. That's a separate right. This does not override that. Matter of fact, some of the original wording of the proposal was to explicitly say none of this is to override the rights of the media to do whatever and so on. So I suggest you don't need that in there because it's not changing it, it's not saying that. And corporations, we had until a number of years ago, we had corporations not playing this role. Corporations did not exist. I mean, in the 1800s when we first had corporations, they were granted their corporate charters by government for a limited purpose for a limited period of time and then they'd go away. Bill Moyers, who always has good understandings of these issues, he said he'll believe a corporation is a person when Texas executes one of them. which is meaningful in several ways. One, to say they're not people, and number two, brings back the idea that once upon a time, if a corporation did something wrong, they could lose their charter. Supreme Court rulings have given them personhood. It's kind of like the Frankenstein movie. Dr. Frankenstein creates this monster, and the monster, we create this monster that runs amok. Humans created these corporations and so on. No, to me, we're saying that corporation that's founded to Koch Brothers industry, which is very much diversified, but they have the right to produce oil and gas and 1,000 other products and buy up other corporations and so on. They have the rights to do that. But my argument is they should have the rights that we as a society give them and the responsibilities we give them and no more, no less. But obviously, I would say that the idea that we're going to take away the free speech of the media, and again, anybody, you can form your own media organization, and you're not going to have as much clout as Fox News and others have because you don't have the money to put behind it, but the media does have its rights to air what it wants. And if you do it right, I'd argue with the public airwaves, we should be saying, if you have public airwaves, you have some obligations. We used to have some of those. In fact, I remember a number of years ago, I got a call from a radio station, I think near Alexandria, Minnesota, not a big time radio station. They wanted to do an interview show, and they were going to tape it for a later broadcast, and I said, when does this program air? It was a half-hour public interest, public stuff there for their licensure. They had to do a half hour of educational stuff or public service stuff each week, and they had a program on what day was mine going to air. 4 a.m. on Easter Sunday. It was a Sunday morning, 4 a.m. I happened to Easter week, you know, I'm sure they have a huge audience.
Yeah.
Probably the guy doing the interview and I were the only two people who ever heard the thing.
Yeah.
But they should, I think we should have as a requirement for public funding for elections, is a candidate has to agree to participate in debates that would be broadcast and so on. Other things, anything else? Go ahead.
This is kind of off the subject, so you could not do it if you don't want to, but what do you think about the Electoral College and its functioning in today's world?
The Electoral College, I'm not a proponent of that. I understand why it was there originally. It served its purpose. It's not one person, one vote, which the Supreme Court has ruled in many cases. And there it can't, because that's constitutionally created. There's an effort going around the country to try and overrule the Electoral College without amending the Constitution by saying as soon as enough states to control a majority of electoral votes, sign on and pass legislation binding them to say that that state's electoral votes will go to the winner of that state, or unless and until enough states to control a majority electoral college have passed a similar law, in which case at that time the electoral votes for that state will go to the winner of the popular vote. And that way, those states would be saying, win or lose, whoever does it will go that way. I happen to think that's fair. Some people, well, then our states would never get any attention. Well, frankly, the states get attention. Why bother with a state that's overwhelmingly Republican or Democratic, even if there are a lot of votes? Or why bother with it? Because all you're going to do by campaigning there is running up the vote total for your party there when you need the resources in these 6 or 8 or 10 swing states. So I happen to think it's a bad process and should be changed. But there are a whole range of other reforms related to this. Obviously, redistricting, where legislators they determine who they're going to represent rather than people determine who's going to represent them. It's very unfair process. Minnesota, the last 4 redistrictings have all been done by the courts because we had a split government at the time and couldn't agree on it, which I think is a good thing that it was drawn by the courts. but that's the way it's been, and I think states that don't have that, Iowa is one of the few states that has a decent process for it, and it tends to be fairer, more competitive races. And I think competitive races are good for democracy, but the money is the biggest game in town, I'd say.
Isn't there any reason why we just couldn't have a popular vote?
If we can amend the Constitution. I would gladly support one to repeal the Electoral College. Difficulty is a state like Wyoming or South Dakota or Alaska, where the population is small, well under a million people, gets two U.S. senators, and even if they don't have enough for one member of Congress, they get one member of Congress. But they get two U.S. senators in California with 50 times their population, maybe more, gets two U.S. senators. And those states don't want to give it up, so it would be very tough to pass a constitutional amendment.
I understand that part. I was thinking more of the presidential election.
No, I'm saying, yeah, right, I know. But the electoral votes go on the members of Congress. So in other words, South Dakota gets three and California gets 48, whatever. So any last one? If not, I appreciate your being here. Happy I'll be around the next week. Happy to talk further. Thank you for your attention.